For those looking for a liberatory martial arts learning approach and curriculum, we've created Liberation Martial Arts. It doesn't just teach you martial arts, it's also an approach to learning movement skills. The whole point of our program is to remove the need for a coach, to liberate you from the need of top-down instruction and toxic gyms. If you have a coach and also have a gym, then you can apply our learning approach to improve your progress. Or maybe you also need a supplemental martial arts community as a counter to the commercial gym you go to. You can actually apply our learning approach to learn anything, and our practitioners are. They're applying it to all sorts of things, whether physical, mental, or even personal. It's just a radically different approach to everything. Sign up for Liberation Martial Arts at the Southpaw Pod Patreon, or support us by signing up for one of the other tiers, and help us support this project while also getting access to bonus content, like early releases of SDS9 with transcripts. SDS9 Season 3 was recorded from the beginning of 2023 to early 2024 and was first published on Patreon. Now that we're done with the season, the entire season is being released all at once on the Southpaw public feed. Find Season 4 on the Southpaw Pod Patreon. This episode was recorded January 21st, 2024. Are back with Southpaw Deep Space 9 Season 3. If you don't know what SDS9 is, it's Southpaw's completest DS9 watch-along show, where we watch every episode, recap it, and analyze it. We are your hosts, Scott and Sam. Scott is someone who's watched DS9 more than once, whereas I'm someone who's casually watched some episodes when it first aired. But this is my first time watching each episode in earnest. I've casually watched a lot of Star Trek, some of the movies. I've probably watched all of The Next Generation. I just don't remember all of the episodes because I didn't watch it multiple times and I watched it when it first aired. Now, with this show, after we watch each episode, we come together and talk about it with today's eyes, but also with a historical and political lens, but also with our own tastes as people who consume and enjoy and have thoughts about entertainment and fiction and writing. And sometimes it can be difficult and painful, especially with the middle episodes, even if they're not even at the middle, sometimes they're towards the end. But we are discussing this episode, episode 20, Improbable Cause. Scott, can you tell us about this episode?
Yes, I would love to. Bashir and Garrick are having a chat about William Shakespeare, or as I like to call him, Billy Shakes. They're talking about Julius Caesar while having lunch at Quark's. Garrick finds it odd that Caesar, being a leader, didn't see his murder coming and sees it more as a farce, that he should have seen the duplicity coming. Garrick thinks humans eat too fast, suspecting a mysterious reason behind it. He says that Bashir never savors food, that humans don't savor food, that he'll see other cultures having lunch and they'll be halfway through their meal and humans will just be done. And that even though that they have more than enough food, they're still acting like there will be, that they will starve, that there's like, you know, not enough. Garrick has a lot of time on his hands because the tailoring business has not been going so great. But also when Garrick's like, hey, I need some pants, he's like, I'll get to it. Kira informs Bashir that there are some issues preparing quarters person, Ulasian ambassador, Bashir made a chemical mix but for the breathing, but it ruined the carpet. And then there's an explosion on the promenade. It is Garrick's shop. It has been attacked, and Garrick laments the trousers may not be ready in time. LOL. Odo and Miles are doing a report. The explosion was due to a power conduit overload juncture rupture, blah, 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 sciencing. Science stuff happened. Odo finds it odd that a rupture would happen just behind Garrick's shop because everyone suspects that Garrick has a shadow past. O'Brien finds nitrolin, which is likely a possible micro-explosive device. Odo thinks it was intentional to make the explosion seem like a whoopsie. Sisko temporarily delays all ship departures. At the sick bay, Odo asks Garrick some questions. Garrick, though, says he's just a tailor. And though it's been suggested that he was a high-ranking member of the Obsidian Order, the Obsidian Order are like the Cardassian secret police, but they're largely getting more and more power in Cardassia and becoming more like the regular law. Garrick says that he was exiled from Cardassia for tax fraud. Uh-huh. No one believes it. As it is Garrick, he is not really being helpful. Garrick is assigned a security detail. Bashir points out that, you know, Garrick is just, he lies so much, and he tells a story about the boy who cried wolf. And Garrick is the boy. And Garrick finds the story interesting and believes that the actual moral and point of the boy who cried wolf is that you should never get caught making the same lie twice. It's delicious. It's great. It's fun writing. Garrick is just what a character. Garrick sees Odo. They look over the visitor logs to see if there is anyone dubious. Odo is reticent to have Garrick look through his security files. No dice. Garrick even suggests that Kira a possible culprit, but she has an airtight alibi. Miles does find some strange residue. An agent that would cause explosion when a certain species was near it. A pheromone device. Ethnicity weapons. Weapons that could sense someone's ethnicity. Which the Flaxian assassins use this pheromone device to do a little hate crime-based murder for hire. And a Flaxian was on board earlier in the day. Odo interrogates the Flaxian named Retia, pretending that he wants to buy some perfumes and cologne. Retia has an alibi. He says he has several colognes. But Odo realizes that when all three of one of these fragrances are combined, they produce a poison. Of course, Retia feigns ignorance. He's free. For now. Miles puts a tracker on Retia's ship, and Odo goes to follow him and then finds Garrick is on his ship. They argue, but ultimately Odo allows Garrick to stay on the mission. And as the Flaxian ship goes into warp, it explodes. Womp. The team posits that the warp device combustion would likely be Romulan technology. And what did Garrick do to get in trouble with the Romulans? When they speak to the Romulans, they admit that they did attack Retia, and they talk to the Tal Shiar, which is like the Romulan intelligence community, and they explain that they had a legit hit out for him for crimes against Romulanity. Yeah, that's a pun I just came up with, for crimes against Romulans. And they don't express any issue with Garrick, although Odo finds it very curious, and Ben is getting frustrated. So the investigation is pretty much at a standstill. Ben and Odo try to hypothesize. They talk Garrick's mysterious past and agree that Odo will visit Cardassia or visit with someone from Cardassia to gather information from his contacts. He still has connections as let's never forget that he is a space cop and was a space cop during the occupation. Remember the thin goo line. Odo is a cop. On a barren moon, Odo meets his informant, a cloaked Cardassian. They both agree that the Romulans probably did try to kill Garrick, but they believe it to be a small piece of a larger issue. Five other Obsidian Order ops were unalive the day before. Three by natural causes. Two by accidents. Coincidence? There are murky indications that it was by Romulans. Odo's contact indicates that this info was in exchange that for a debt and is encouraged to show the names of the unalived Cardassians to Garak, and that if Odo has more information to share, they could continue to have a relationship where they share information. It can be noted that this contact does insist that Garak was in the Obsidian Order, again, which is something that Garak will continue to say is not true. When shown the list, Garak knows all the operatives. He even suggests that he would celebrate. Odo then deduces that Garak blew up his own shop. Garak sensed that Retia was there to poison him and preemptively attacked, and that there was joy in Garak seeing his business burn, because he doesn't want to be a tailor. He is a Cardassian in exile who seemingly loves everything about Cardassia. A complex character. Garak tells Odo that he and the other five Cardassians who are unalive were tight with Enna Brentane, the retired boss of the Obsidian Order, a rarity, because most Obsidian bosses do not retire. Garak attempts to hit up Tane and gets Micah, Tane's housekeeper and confidant, who's on the line, and is emotional to see Garak and talk with them. Tane is gone, split the day before. Myla asks Garak to help Tane, and he's okay with it. They acknowledge that there is a relationship and an ending of a relationship. And if you see Season 2, Episode 22, The Wire, you can hear a little bit more about this dyad. And we obviously covered it on the show together. Forever. Garak and Odo dip in a runabout to find Tane. Before getting on the runabout, Garak asks Bashir to find secrets in his lair, but it seems to be a joke. Bashir gives Garak some Delavian chocolate, a treat they talked about earlier. Their relationship should have gone deeper. We got to talk about this later. On the runabout, Odo and Garak discuss matters and how both of them use duplicity and lies and control. Garak does admit that Tane means something to him and that he believes that he owes him something. They verbally spar. It is delicious. Garak is in exile, so to go to Cardassian space to find Tane suggests a deeper connection. Odo posits Tane was training Garak to be his successor. And Garak also says that Odo is unfeeling, that he follows the law but doesn't have strong emotions or reasons, that he is a cop for a code but lacks love in his life. Garak finds it curious that Odo projects emotions on him that Odo does not show. Garak accuses Odo of treating people like puzzles, like things. And Garak asks Odo if he cares about anyone. We know that he has one, at least one unrequited love, and that is for Kira. But he says, I'm not telling you. And Garak says, that's for best. In Cardassian space, a Romulan Firebird shows up and tries to capture Odo and Garak. They're taken to a Romulan ship. We see Tane. He makes jokes about killing him and throws shade at Garak's tailoring skills. Garak fat-shames Tane. They just throw a bunch of hate at each other. Garak makes an ethnic slur about the Romulans as a test to see what is going on between Tane and the Romulans, because there's so much trickery in the Cardassian politics. It's like, I'm seeing how you'll respond to this to show me what the relationship is with these people and what's going on there. Because if you don't do this, it means this. And if you do this, it means this. And 1 + 1 = 3. You know what I'm saying? No one knows anything. So the Romulans and the Cardassians, or at least the Obsidian Order and the Tal Shiar, have agreed to form a fleet to attack the Dominion. The Dominion being the force on the other side of the wormhole. But again, this is a clandestine act. And as we talked about earlier, the Obsidian Order is gaining more and more power in the Cardassian world. Their goal is, they know where the founders are, who we recently met at the beginning of this season, they're going to wipe out the Founders and end the war by destroying the Founder planet and the Great Link. And they're saying this all to Odo, who is technically a Founder, a changeling, part of all of this. And Garak asks why Tane tried to kill him. Tane admits that after all of this, Tane plans to leave retirement, and he was just cleaning up all loose ends. Garak reveals that he came to save Tane. Garak is dismissed, but also given the offer to end his exile and help Tane. Garak will help Tane. Odo is caught in the ship. To be continued.
A note to our listeners. If you love the Southpaw Project, please support us and help us get paid for our labor by financially supporting us on Patreon. This will give you access to exclusive bonus content, like early releases of Southpaw Deep Space Nine, our fictional narrative podcast, Fighter's Brew, break-free versions of our shows without interruptions like you're hearing now, bonus articles, Fighter's Brew transcripts with extra content, Liberation Martial Arts Online, as well as our private chat group on Discord. You can also make one-time donations at Ko-Fi or show your solidarity by wearing our swag. You can find all pertinent links at southpawpod.com. So let's start with the fast-eating observation of humans and the want to hoard and feel like you never have enough. And it feels like a criticism of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the writers were actually thinking, but let's just say that's what it was, and let's just go with that. This episode had a lot of great foreshadowing. There was the scene where Dr. Bashir brought up the boy who cried wolf, and Garak said, maybe the point isn't about not lying or no one will believe you, but that it's about not telling the same lie twice. If you see Garak as a former CIA agent, or maybe he still is an agent, that's completely in line with what a CIA agent and what the CIA would say, because the CIA and the US itself has proven over and over that you can keep lying and people will keep believing it. You can even keep telling the same lies over and over and many people will still believe you. People will believe lies if it confirms their bias. I like this scene because Garak douses cold water on that whole story where we assume a lie told over and over again doesn't work. The US constantly cries wolf about a metaphorical wolf, and people keep believing it because it confirms their bias about a metaphorical wolf, the dangerous other. Where the boy fucked up is he didn't spend time sowing fear in the people about the outsiders, about the dangerous other.
And creating lies, yeah.
But that's what the CIA or the Obsidian Order is good at. The boy who cried wolf is just a failed propaganda program. And to the CIA or State Department or the Obsidian Order, instead of the lesson being, see, so don't try it, their takeaway is, well, what can we learn from this so we can do better next time? Power politics doesn't stop after one hurdle. They'll keep going until they get what they want. There was also the foreshadowing of Caesar. Again, to a former CIA agent, it's more about how Caesar failed to gather enough intel about the assassination attempt. The CIA is all about gathering information while spreading disinformation. Garak said, how can the head of the state not know there is an assassination attempt on him? But then again, what if it's the very people whose job is to gather intel that tries to kill you? This can be foreshadowing of things we'll find out about DS9. I don't know. But it could also be a play. It made me think about JFK because he had his own feud with the CIA, which was now starting to get its legs and gaining more and more power. And we saw how that went. But Scott, what did you think about the use of metaphors here and kind of flipping the script on old stories from the perspective of Garak?
It was excellent. I think early Deep Space Nine is at its best when we get to learn about our characters. And even when you realize that, like, hey, I don't think I like Garak very much right now. And it's impossible to understand where his alliances lead. It makes for good story, and it makes for great political writing. Because again, like, the convention of lies and double talk and code is so part of the intelligence playbook. And in how we can just talk about America, you know, use devices for overthrowing governments and messing up governments and doing all this stuff. And yeah, how, I mean, I don't want to go too deep into JFK, but, you know, he didn't die of natural causes. I don't like to go too deep into conspiracy theories, because I think there's enough stories where you're like, wait, there's no conspiracy. Like, governments and similarly like bodies have done some wild things, and it's not even a secret. It's just like, what did he really do to tick off his own country where he may have been, you know? It's just complicated. I don't know exactly what happened, and I'm not trying to go too deep into it. Nor do I want to get flagged for talking about JFK, but I'm just saying that the Obsidian Order would definitely get a guy like JFK out of here. That's all I'm saying. And I don't think that's a totally wild thing to say. The book Chaos came out a couple of years ago and tries to look at the Manson murders, and not that it was a psyop, but that maybe Manson was trained how to do that sort of stuff from intelligence agencies, that he was an op. So I just always find it interesting, like, what you can do and what you can do with the truth. And in the previous episode, we were talking about Garak episodes. I mean, Garak episodes are going to be some of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine you get. Bashir says to him, well, which parts were true? And he was like, well, especially the lies were the true ones, or something like that. So it's just about how in this sort of dangerous game of information, there is no truth.
I mean, if you want to talk about Obsidian Order and going back to even Manson, right? We do know for sure he was in the MK Ultra program.
Exactly.
They were experimenting on him. And so there's such a direct parallel to the Obsidian Order double talk, because the US did such a good job, even to this day, of talking about other governments and communism just brainwashing people all the time. If anybody from the US leaks stuff about the anti-communist, like, atrocities, genocides the US were doing, the US simply just said, oh, that person was being brainwashed by the communists. They did a whole McCarthyism Red Scare within the US with the loyalty oath and everything, because those lies, that disinformation about brainwashing programs were so strong. Like, people really believed they were just these, like, sleeper agents who were completely brainwashed, where they're completely, like, pro-American until you say a trigger word and all of a sudden, like, something happens, right? People still to this day believe this stuff. Yet the double talk, the Obsidian Order lies to hide the truth, and lies on top of lies, is that no country and no government spent more money on brainwashing and mind control and spent more time on this than the US, because they had the MK Ultra program and many other programs. And they did a lot of their experiments on who, right? The marginalized people. They did it on Black and Indigenous people because they didn't want to hurt white people. But then there were some white people they did get too, right? Like Charles Manson and other people, where they, I think Whitey Bulger was another guy who was in the MK Ultra program. So it's wild how they did it. Then convinced everybody here that it was everybody else doing it. And nobody even had the resources to do what the US did. And on top of that, if you think about the ability to control narratives, right? No country has the network to control public opinion and news, information media like the US as well, right? So again, this is so much like Obsidian Order. I'm pretty sure the writers didn't think about that. But in that type of Garak-esque kind of annoying, like, what's the real truth? Like, what are you saying? Why do you keep like deflecting to all this other stuff? That has been the US, and that has been how, like Garrick's example of the boy who cried wolf, they keep lying and lying, but maybe the boy wasn't that good, but you could actually keep telling a lie and get people to believe it.
Exactly. Now this is a 4-star episode. This is 4 out of 5. It's veering on a 4.5. It's just that the show hasn't even gotten great yet. I love it, but it isn't what I love about it yet. Right now, if we're just a little Scott, you know, I'm 13, 14 years old, I'm like, this show's cool. But like, if I missed it, like I wouldn't run home to watch every single episode.
You weren't the diehard yet.
No, the only thing I would run home for was The Simpsons or In Living Color, because I did not want to be at school not knowing about it.
I really enjoyed the scenes with Odo and Garrick. They're the same, but different. It also shows how not all enforcement agents act the same, and how different departments can act differently, all for the same interests. People only recognize a cop when they act like Odo, but not when they act like Garrick or even like Cisco. Undercover cops act different from the sheriff. Administrative cops act differently from the sheriff also. But it's all the same. It's all rules-based order enforcement, which is what Garrick likes about both Odo and Cisco. He even says Odo would have been a great fit for the Obsidian Order. Scott, what did you think about the contrast in different enforcers of the rules-based order, Odo and Garrick?
I think it's just like very interesting seeing two sides of the same coin, you know? Except Odo has this almost fetishistic need to be part of the truth and the righteous, and we don't know what is pulling Garrick. But yeah, Odo would have been great in the Obsidian Order, because the Odo that we know now just is a law fetishist.
You know what's interesting is his principles, his personality is unchanging, but he is a changeling. So he has the physical ability to change and be whatever lie you want it to be whoever you want it to be, right? Which is such a powerful tool for an organization like the Obsidian Order. They would love to have an agent like that, right? So it's also a contrast, if you think about it, where he's the changeling. So he is the physical embodiment of lies. Yet he often just chooses to be the same form, and his personality is rock hard. Garrick, his form is always going to be the same, but everything that comes out of his mouth is the changeling. It's always changing, right? That contrast, that I don't even know if the writers were thinking about that contrast, but also in designing Odo as a character, that contrast, we never talked about that. The fact that he physically is a changeling, whereas his personality is unchanging. He's like a rock, right? And I think that also makes that character so interesting, and also makes Garrick's contrast with them so interesting, because they're the same. They're a changeling, but also stone-like, but in inverse relationship with each other.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a CIA agent and an FBI agent.
Garrick is the changeling, right? In that he's changed into, or pretending to be, a tailor. So he too is a changeling. He just uses words rather than his body.
Yeah. He is a shapeshifter. And one thing that I want to talk about, I don't know if you were going to bring it up, but basically something that frustrates the producers of Deep Space Nine and, you know, Andrew Robinson, who played Garrick, is not having Garrick and Bashir have a physical affection. You know, in retrospect, you could definitely queer code these characters, at least a lot of writers have, and see that there's definitely an attraction. And, you know, sorry, Andrew Robinson even played the character like he was trying to have relations with Bashir. But they weren't going to do that 20, 30 years ago. Deep Space Nine had its 30-year anniversary recently. So they weren't going to do that then. And I wish they were less afraid to make that so subtextual. But if you want to have fun during the pandemic, there's a Zoom teleplay called Little Achievements, where Alexander Siddig and Andrew Robinson play if Bashir and Garrick were in a relationship. And it's awesome.
If you love the Southpaw Project, become one of our financial supporters. It'll help us supplement the cost of running this project, the incredible time and energy we put into it 7 days a week, and you'll be giving us some breathing room, not only to juggle Southpaw with our day jobs, but also to expand Southpaw into other areas. We can't exist without your contributions. Show your Southpaw solidarity by supporting us at southpawpod.com. Now, going back to Garrick and Odo, why do you think people have the most animus for the street cop when they're lowest on the power hierarchy and people have a hard time seeing those higher on that power scale as cops or top cops?
I can't answer that question right now. I think about like cops and copaganda and shows about cops. And if I'm allowed to enjoy them all the time, I don't know, man.
I think there is something to something you said, right? Where we know more about where Odo stands. And with Garrick, we don't know where he's coming from, right? When we were talking about different enforcement agents. And I think it's the fact that we do know where Odo stands, what he's about. He's just so much simpler. It's easier for us to have animus towards him. Whereas anybody above him, they're more mysterious. We don't know what they want, right? If it's the person at the street level, it's like obviously it's some kind of power dynamic or racism, right? It's very black and white. As it goes up, it feels more complicated, right? Because you're like, well, they can't be just motivated by that because they're not directly getting to enjoy that, right? They don't get their hands dirty. So it's not like they get direct enjoyment from that. So what's motivating these people? What's driving these people, right? And so I think that part of the answer is that the street level person, the Odos, are simpler, right? In the hierarchy, somebody like Garrick would be much higher on the power scale, would be much more powerful, would be Odo's boss. And the higher they go, the more indirect, the more non-directly they are affecting people. They're not at that street level. They're not the ones directly putting their hands on people. And so they become, I think, for people harder to imagine, like imagine what they're about. Because they're not dealing with them. They don't ever deal with them, right? So it's more they exist as an idea. Whereas cops, almost everybody's had interaction with cops. People above those cops, you don't have interactions with them. So it almost allows them to get off the hook because we only know them through stories or in the news or just as a title or from deduction. We know they exist. We've never talked to them. We never had run-ins with them, but we know they're there, right? And I think that level of abstraction makes them seem, I guess, less bad. Or maybe if we really intellectualize it, we do know they're worse. But when we just go by gut feeling, that's not what our gut says. Because gut feeling is purely about what's directly engaging with you, what you're directly interacting with. And I think that's one of the takeaways I've been constantly trying to like convey through the show is like, gut feeling is a good start, but you can't stop there. Your gut feeling will tell you like the person who is bad, but lowest on the hierarchy is the source of all the problems. That's where the gut feeling is wrong. The gut feeling is a spider sense that tells you that's where the trail begins, but that is not where the trail ends.
It's also the difference between praxis and behavior. You know, that's sometimes what I find different from like people who call themselves conservatives or Republicans is that they just are feeling nothing else. No truth, no reaction, no praxis. It's just gut reaction and bad intuition played into by a malevolent media machine. it's much harder to try to do this political stuff with knowledge, with theory. Though I do argue that maybe for some people, like, you know, theory's too much, and they're like, look, I know that I agree with you. I know I agree with socialism. Some of the language is a little too like dense for me, but I vibe with it. Can you tell me the vibes? I almost like want to get ChatGPT to rewrite Das Kapital in vibe language.
Summarize it for me.
Yeah. Cause like that book is the truth, but it is dense, man. It is like hard to read.
I mean, I think all of us who are on the socialist spectrum, who are liberatory, when we're dealing with people in real life, it's always a challenge when we're trying to talk to them about different ways to think about things. And you're trying to connect with them human to human, where you don't lose them, you don't confuse them. And every time there's no formula, it's difficult, right?
Absolutely.
When we get to finding out that different members of the Obsidian Order were murdered, we get into the passive and active language we know so well in Western media, killed versus died. These people died. They weren't killed, because you can't say killed unless you're ready to accuse the murderer. And the West doesn't ever want to accuse itself or accuse agents of the rules-based order. Standalone, this episode, the way it's written, is strong. But just because how we can now map on so many discussion topics onto this episode also makes it so strong. Like the theme of the rules-based order and different enforcers of that. And how, if you're ever talking about things the rules-based order did, you can't ever accuse them. You can't even acknowledge them. That's why you got to say died, not killed.
Right. I mean, if you look at people trying to, in the moment of what's going on in Gaza and other parts of the world where there is oppression, the way that the news changes the language based on the people killed, murdered, died, was young, baby, you know what I mean? You're seeing it happen in real time, that certain populations are afforded kindness and generosity in description that other populations are not. And it's why language is so powerful, and you know how Noam Chomsky realized the world was so messed up. I mean, he's on my shit list right now, but him figuring out through being a linguist the inequities of what's going on in the world, it shows you the importance of words and language and the machine.
And that whole scene itself in the dark, you know, almost like a parking lot scene, people in the shadows, that was also just tremendous. Because that's where we get introduced to this informant, which is a trope, the informant in the shadows, but it fits with the cloak and dagger theme of this episode. So just, not even politics, right? Just the way that scene was captured, the way it looked. What did you think about that scene with Odo and the spy?
I loved it. It was a great episode. Give me more of that sort of shit.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you something else that's freaky is DS9 aired the same year as X-Files. And it gave me a lot of those kind of X-Files vibe with the guy in the shadows, you know, who's like smoking a cigarette or something.
Oh, yeah, it's totally on some X-Files shit.
Then we end this episode where the Obsidian Order really acts like the CIA and the U.S. State Department, acting out the Western notion of self-defense, which we see right now with Israel and the rest of the West, where self-defense means strike first, kill them all, which includes invasion and war crimes. It's not that dissimilar from Western self-defense classes, which is also influenced by cops, U.S. military, and even the IDF and Krav Maga, where self-defense also means offense. Self-defense becomes the excuse to be the assailant. So as a martial artist and also a political observer, that whole ending scene has so many parallels. But also something I talk and write a lot about is this notion of self-defense. We assume we know what that means, but then if there is a consensus to what that means, unpack it, because the consensus definition of self-defense is really a problem.
Right. And if liberation martial arts is self-defense and Krav Maga is self-offense, it's oppression martial arts. It's the exact opposite of what the liberation martial arts tries to imbue.
Did you have thoughts about the theme of self-defense in this episode, especially at the end when it made clear what the episode was about? Because that's what they're saying. They're defending themselves.
Yeah, I had strong thoughts. I mean, I think this episode and episodes where we go into Garrick and we go into Cardassian politics, we're going into the U.S. war machine and the Western war machine and what that means.
Now, Scott, what did you think overall about this episode? I know you already gave us some comments, but what did you think about this episode, especially in comparison to the last episode, Through the Looking Glass, which both of these episodes are about politics?
I mean, I just feel like when you have Odo and Garrick in the same room, just like eating the furniture, you know what I mean? Like Rene Aubergenois, just like killing it, just getting both of them in the room for the longest time they've been so far on the show. You just are reminded that most of the cast of Star Trek are well-respected, well-regarded actors doing well-respected, well-regarded acting. And I think this episode is just really, it's tight, it's written well, it plays with you, and I forgot that it was a two-parter until like the last scene. I was like, yeah, wait, they're not going to be able to wrap this up so quick.
My favorite scenes, and there were multiple, were, like you said, just put them in the room together. And what happens whenever you put these two characters in the room together? They both can't help themselves from trying to interrogate each other. So they're both interrogating each other, but in different ways, right? Odo is just much more direct. It is so much more obvious that he is interrogating Garrick, right? But then Garrick will flip it around and do it his coy way, but he's interrogating him about who do you have feelings for, trying to get information out of him. And now it's like Odo is in the hot seat. And it's like, wait, when did that flip? When did this whole power dynamic flip? And they just kept going back and forth. It was, to use your words, right? Delicious.
Delicious. That's all I can say.
Scott, tell us about the next episode.
Well, the die is cast. More Cardassian shadow play is at stake.
Until then. If you like this episode and like what we do, support us on Patreon. We also have the Liberation Martial Arts program if you want to train with us from wherever you are. It's both theory and practice and removes the need for an instructor. What you're learning is how to teach yourself. It's also an approach you can take with you from the gym into the world. Sponsors get a monthly training session with me, either in person or online. Supporting me not only helps me pay my bills, but it also helps me support my family. Find all our links, including Southpaw merch, at southpawpod.com.